second episode of Hindu Muslim Hi Hi presented by Gadar Radio. And today we are going to talk about what else but Corona and the COVID crisis that is engulfing our nation. In Culture Kush, we have the movie Wag the Dog. In joint effort, we are going to give you guys updates about the Gadar organizations that have happened last month. And in Puff Puff Talk, we have Sunita Vishwanath from Hindus for Human Rights with us, who will tell us about their ideology and what they've been doing for COVID in India. So to give our listeners a little context of what has happened since the pandemic, I think, Miraj, we should do a little rundown of the highlights since March.
Definitely. So much has happened. All the way from Tali, Thali, Diya, Mombatti to everything.
Okay, so Indians were requested...
At some point, I was seriously thinking that I should go and bang Thali. It's like, I was done.
So we should give the context though, right?
Thoda? Yes.
Okay. So our Prime Minister would come on every Sunday and speak to the nation and then give us different tasks to do, like Survivor or one of those reality shows, that go outside on the balcony and bang thalis and support, bang pots and pans and plates in support of frontline workers. And the next weekend it was light diyas and candles for the frontline workers and people that have been affected by COVID. All of this was, well, whatever, you know. I mean, any person with common sense can understand what this means. What was he trying to do, Miraj? Like, what does this mean?
You are just anti-national people. You just know how to criticize our loving prime minister. The best thing was that it was not the weirdness of all of this. The arguments that the whole right-wing troll army started giving, at some point it was about the cosmic energy that will be emanated from you
banging thalis and that will cure corona.
I think his idea was that he saw that people are like cheering up in Italy and he was, okay, why not we do this? It looks cool. He is all about looking cool, right? So he was like, it will look cool. And then he asked people to do this and people went on crazy. They're like on streets dancing with thali. He was like, just go on your balcony and clap. And
yeah, there was no like lockdown. There were like scores of people banging thalis together. And I'm like, that was not the point of this. You had to stay in lockdown and stay isolated. You're not supposed to make it a festival. But I think we Indians know how to make everything a festival. So
right.
I guess that was where it started. Should we talk about just highlights? I know we talked about thalis and stuff, but let's talk about what happened. Shaheen Bagh, which was the biggest anti-CAA protest, majority was led by Muslim women in Delhi. That was shut down because of COVID, which, I mean, I get it, rightfully slow, so. But there were a lot of contradictions. There was a Tablighi Jamaat, which I think, Miraj, you can talk about. It was in March, and there was a pilgrimage that was still on, and which was blamed for a COVID outbreak when Tirupati, which is a very big Hindu temple, was still open to 40,000 people.
Yeah, it was easy target.
Yeah, what else happened after that? After Tablighi Jamaat got blamed for all our problems in life.
Yeah, then Hindu Mahasabha conducts Gomutra party to cure coronavirus. That was amazing.
Oh, that was the Go Corona Gova, right?
Yeah, that was the Go Corona Gova.
That video has so many parodies, guys. I think I suggest going to social media and checking out Go Corona Go remixes, because that's giving me life.
Yeah, by 22nd PM woke up, is like, there will be no more people. There will be sudden curfew.
Yeah, was, so, I want to talk about this curfew, though. So, on 22nd, he said, okay, India lockdown, you get 4 hours for the lockdown, which just basically means that people with cars can go back to their houses, but what about the gigantic migrant population? How are they going to get on trains and go back home? Or people who are from cities going back to rural India? I don't think they thought this through. When I saw this, and I was like, are you crazy? Who are you? You're basically catering to people who can go to their houses in 4 hours.
I mean, that is the pattern. Nothing has been thought through right from the beginning of the COVID crisis. And that led to a massive internal migration in India, like of which has not been seen after the independence. when the partition happened.
Right.
There are like people walking on the streets for thousands of kilometers going back to, because there were no trains, no buses, there was nothing available for all those people who suddenly lost their jobs, daily wagers, who work every day. And if the city is closed, cities, big cities like Mumbai and Delhi and other places where people go all the way from Bihar and West Bengal to work, suddenly the work vanished in these cities, and obviously they had no place to go. So what they can do, they can go back home. They just can't live there.
So what that means is in 4 hours, you're curbing this and then allowing these migrants, some of whom might have been exposed to COVID, go to rural India and spread COVID there. So we already had flights coming into India with passengers, with the elite carrying COVID. And now you're giving it to everybody and the poor who can't really defend themselves. So it just had the opposite impact of what it's supposed to have.
Right.
Because it was a premature lockdown, really.
Right. So the lockdown happened on 25th. The 22nd was a Janta curfew, which was, was a, I think, a 4 hour.
So after, you know, we thought that, okay, there was a lockdown for several months. We had the biggest farmers protest in the world, which started on August 9th, 2020. It was against, there were three farm laws that the government passed very quietly without opposition, without consulting farmers about the existing farm laws. And that started happening, and this was like the biggest protest that the world has seen for farmers. The PM started his PM Cares Fund, which collected lots of monies. It collected some like crores of money in like 4 days. Nobody knows how much money he has because you cannot audit it.
And it's funny that there is a PM Relief Fund in India, yes, which is a public fund, which is, yes, audited, which is...
Yeah. So there was already... no need
to have a PM Cares Fund.
So apparently then came a time that we all had beaten COVID and everybody was happy. Everybody was mingling because, again, India festivals, right? And then, like, I remember my mom telling me that Modi has distributed vaccines in 140 countries. And I was like, wait, how many vaccines do we have? We have a 1/8 of the world population in India. Why is he sending vaccines?
Right. The good thing I like about the BJP IT cell and their propaganda team is that they come with really cool one-liners, really cool names. Like, India suddenly became the world pharmacy for COVID-19.
I think I say this every episode probably, but their marketing, their PR, their IT cell, man, hats off to them. They like make everything sound so amazing. If you don't look, you won't know what's happening. You'll be like, huh, everything is great. Everything is changa. But
I wonder if 10 years or 5 years from now, like whenever this nightmare will end, they will start teaching this Modi wave as a marketing success. That should be done, like a case study,
business school case study. Yeah, right. That would be great.
I think we should also learn from Patanjali how they have totally taken the nationalism thing and started doing like amazing marketing. Before, Baba Ramdev was like Ribjean and West idea and all these things bullshit, and now Ribjean is suddenly Sanskari.
Wait, what? I did not know about this. So you're saying that Baba Ramdev has his own line of Ribjeans now?
Yes. It's Sanskari now. It has blessings of Baba Ramdev.
No way. Are you kidding? You're not joking.
No, dude, I'm serious. Baba, I have seen a video somewhere on YouTube. I can put the link. If some people are like, no, you are lying. I definitely know.
Oh, that. I just completely missed it because I would have totally made more memes.
I think I saw it on a meme or something. I don't remember. But there was something.
I'm not convinced, but okay, if you can share the link, we should put it down in our description. And then we come to this year, guys. We are not even done.
The spreading
super
happened.
Spreader, which was supposed to be the second wave, was the Kumbh Mela. It happens every few years. It was supposed to happen next year, but it got moved now. Guess why? Elections. So, and apparently the position of some planets, but who cares? So it started with a lot of people, Hindus, going to Allahabad for this Kumbh Mela. And on April 14th, there was a Shahi Snan, which is when you take a holy dip in the Ganges. And 900,000 people, more than 900,000 people took a dip. When India had about 199 like almost 200k cases, new cases. UP government actually took out all like front page newspaper ads telling people to come to the Kumbh Mela. There were special trains, 25 special trains for these pilgrimage and for the pilgrimage. And I just wonder why there wasn't any trains for migrant workers. But now we have 25 trains for this kind of stuff, which should have been... We were in lockdown that time. A lot of places were. Overall, 3.5 million people attended this festival which went on for a week.
So what it says is that the government, if wants, has the resources and has the capacity to run these kind of facilities. They just chose not to during the migrant crisis.
For migrant workers, because their lives are dispensable. People died of starvation and just being on their feet without food, water for thousands of kilometers going back to their house.
Yeah, the most heartbreaking story that I read was the story of this kid who was about 13 or 14 who walked all the way, and he died just few kilometers away from his home.
That is so sad.
And it was just heartbreaking.
And this is the time when he was collecting PM funds, PM CARES funds. I remember because like our friends in India were raising money and I was sending links to different WhatsApp groups and people, and all my friends were like, oh, we are donating to PM CARES. And I was just like, I know
just
these.
Doesn't care.
Yeah, I was like, I know the people who are working grassroots. Why don't you just donate to them? I know them. They're like outside trucks and, you know, loading food. But I guess PM does care in their head. And then should we talk about the rallies? Last thing.
Oh yes. The election rallies, West Bengal election rallies after rallies. I don't have the count. But on April 17, in one huge rally, PM was saying, "Maine jahan bhi dekhu, mujhe log hi dikhte hain aur kuch nahi. I mean, wherever I see, I just see people. I don't see anything else." And he was in Asansol on April 17th. At the same day, the number of cases, new cases reported was 264,000 new cases. And That's like mind-boggling. While the whole world was just trying to avoid people. And then on 22nd, the EC just woke up and decided that, okay, 500 people is the limit. You cannot have more than 500 people.
EC is the Election Commission of India. Who, I mean, they don't really have a spine usually, but I think now they're realizing that it's too apparent. So.
Yeah, I think that now the it has a systematic undermining of the institutions, right? From the Election Commission to the Supreme Court.
So, and then we come to this Central Vista project, which has been in the works since a few months now. And it has been classified as essential work when the whole world knows that the COVID crisis is going on. RPM is doing a beautification project for the parliament and the buildings around, and it is costing us $2.8 billion. I don't see how the right wing can spin this, but when I posted about it, somebody from who's a troll of mine, I love my trolls,
it's really cute how you say a troll of mine is like the idea that you have.
So a troll of mine said that, oh, that's a different budget, the Central Vista project and statues. I said, are you kidding? So make it one budget. Aren't we paying for it? Aren't our taxes paying for all of this shit? How is that not our budget or a separate budget? $2.8 billion when the country is gasping for oxygen is a lot of money, guys. I don't know what to say. Miraj, you can...
Dr. Harshvardhan has a solution for that. You don't need $2.8 billion. You need just cow dung to cure it, and you need a kada and bleach is obviously there.
Okay.
Anyway, on a serious note, dissenters in jail.
Yes, we have to talk about them. Our last episode was about political prisoners, and they were thrown in jail right after lockdown happened. So the government sneakily put UAPA charges on a lot of intellectuals and activists and students who were in the protests and put them in jail. Recently, Natasha Narwal from Pinjratore's father, Mahavir Narwal, also died of COVID, which is really sad. She got bail a few hours after her dad died. It's really heartbreaking, and she was a friend of a friend, and it was really hard to see that happen. But this is just like one case, you know. There's so many people. Like when you see those Reuters images of sand corpses and people throwing corpses in the Ganga because they don't have money or resources to cremate or bury their dead, it is horrendous what's happening. These images will forever haunt us, and I hope that people wake up and, you know, don't say everything was changa, because it's not.
No, it isn't. It's just sad.
It's sad, but maybe if we chant go corona go, everything will go away.
Mix it with the absurdity. These are all distractions. Everything this government does is a distraction. Right from we talked about the Tablighi Jamaat all the way to Thali and everything. Even this Shahi Snan was just a distraction from what we have been going through.
Yeah. And talking of distractions, we should talk about our next section, which is in Culture Kush, which is the movie called Wag the Dog. It was released in 97. It is by the director Barry Levinson. It is an American political satire black comedy, and it stars Dustin Hoffman and Robert De Niro. Basically, the plot is that there is a fixer in the White House who approaches a Hollywood producer to fabricate a war in Albania to distract voters from a presidential sex scandal. So, like, the presidential elections is in 11 days, and they have to come up with a distraction so that he can get reelected. Barry Levinson, who's the director, he's done amazing movies, Good Morning Vietnam, Rain Man, and Disclosure, and he has also produced a lot of other movies. This movie itself, Wag the Dog, won a lot of awards, and it was nominated for more. And I want to ask Miraj what he thought of the movie. And I suggested it because I had seen it as a kid, and I remembered, you know, that it was being a good movie then. So what do you think?
It's definitely funny. There are points and absurd too. But it is chilling. And chilling in the way that how close it hit to home. It was as if I was looking just a different version of Indian political system. And that reminded me of all the distractions created by the Modi government. Like every time there was a failure, there was a distraction. Pulwama happened on February 14th, 2019. And then general elections happened. And so you see that there is a direct, like, we don't really know what is happening behind the scenes.
Yeah, remember like SSR suicide case that took up like 4 months? I mean, 4 weeks?
Was your drugs
that
though,
was a
drugs
big
though.
Distraction. That's how our title came about. We were going to have drugs though in our title card. But Arnab's voice is so displeasing that we were like, no, not going to happen.
Talking about the movie, back to track.
Yeah, so that we're talking about all these distractions. So anytime there is something which happens, Modi will start crying on screen, literally, to distract you. Do not fall for his tricks. Do not blame crocodiles because they are lovely creatures, but do not believe his tears. There's always a mandir that needs saving, guys. Don't fall for it.
There is always a mandir. There is always a mandir that needs to be built. There is always a mosque that needs to go.
Demolished. Yes,
that is exactly the whole thing. I was wondering while watching this movie that does Bollywood has it in it anymore to make a movie like this? We know that there were movies like Parzania, which was made in 2005. There was Firaq and Black Friday.
Yeah, there's Black Friday. I used to like that movie. I saw like it was censored. I remember watching like a ripped cam print in college because we couldn't see it. I don't think they, at least now till the BJP is in power, I just see propaganda pieces like PM Narendra Modi and all of those very heavy propaganda movies becoming popular. But I don't see it happening till BJP is in power. It's not like the Congress is better, but I don't know. It felt that now Hindutva is on an exponential rise rather than when Congress was in power.
It also could be because of the kind of pressure that is on Bollywood to just fall in line.
Yes. Yeah. So anytime something happens, Rihanna tweets and then there's Akshay Kumar and Ajay Devgan and all these people who have to back the government. They've been paid or not paid. I don't know what's the same. But they have to fall in line. And the people who and so many people don't comment. Like the big guys don't, the actors don't even try to get into this, which is really sad. But yeah, that is the fact. I don't think it's going to happen soon. I have faith in Anurag Kashyap though. But
yeah, let's see. I do. And I was thinking after watching this movie, and Parzania, for example, has such an effect on me. I just can't forget that movie. And I just can't forget some of the scenes in there. And I was wondering that, the impact of movies and songs on how people think, and does it change people's worldview? Has your worldview about something really changed after you watched a movie?
I mean, it's obviously documentaries change your worldview easily. There's also like a lot of nonfiction that does that. Well, Wag the Dog is one that you know, they're creating a complete war. But there's also, like, one of my favorite movies is called Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind by Michael Gondry. And it is not political. It is about man and woman. They are in a relationship. The relationship goes sour and the girl decides to remove him from his memories. And on hearing that, the guy goes like, I need revenge, so I'm going to remove her from my memories.
Hmm.
And in the process of removing his memories, he decides, no, I actually want the memories.
Right.
So it taught me that there's always darkness, but you need the darkness for light to exist. It always asks the question, is ignorance bliss?
Right.
And, you know, do you want to swallow the red pill or the blue pill?
Even knowing that there is a red pill and blue pill, it's like, oh shit, now I have
being
to choose.
Aware. Yeah, being aware of right. the fact that you can you handle the truth. Right. But yeah, that's what I think.
How often do you get a chance to work on sets of meaningful movies?
The movie is called Cuck. Yes, you heard it right. Cuck. It is available online, and it's a very polarizing film. It's very intense. It's sort of like Joker, the movie. And it's about this loner dude who becomes involved in alt-right vloggers and starts making his own videos, which are very alt-right. And, you know, like, Muslims should get out of the country type person. And he talks about Trump's America, and the director, Rob, wanted to showcase that mentality of, you know, how does one become this person? Unemployment or, you know, the way, how his story, really. It's a decent film. It could have been slightly better because I felt the character was one-tone a little bit. But I think it achieves its goal of trying to humanize people who are on the right as well.
Right.
You know? Right. Like, all of us are people. All of us have biases. We probably, both of us, are left biased.
Right.
I'm trying not, we actively try not to be, right? We have to like do research, see what the right wing is saying, and then make up our minds. But it takes active effort in this age of misinformation to not be misinformed.
The purpose of polarization is to raise walls so that people can't talk to each other.
We are trying to remove those walls by weed. I'm hoping that I can share a joint with a Sanghi person and not kill that person. Hopefully that'll happen.
I doubt anybody can kill on weed. It's like it's too calming. It's like you're...
Yeah, right?
Yeah, you're so relaxed.
I wonder why it's not legal everywhere. It's like the most calming thing. Alcohol gets people more riled up than weed does. Okay, so going back to our Wag the Dog movie, which we went on a tangent... You know, there's that scene in which all of them are sitting around the table and they're talking about voting and they're like, no, I don't vote.
Right.
The rooms are too claustrophobic. Yes. That was so brilliant.
It is brilliant, yes.
It was so brilliant when all of them are admitting to, no, no, I don't vote. I don't vote. This is stupid. I don't know.
Like all
you,
of,
you want to say something?
All of those cool friends of mine who are like, I'm apolitical. I don't talk about politics. It's just too under me. I'm just too cool to to talk about politics. And like, dude, if you are not talking about politics, that is politics. You have a choice. You have a privilege to, and it was so obvious that those people who were talking about that, oh no, I don't go to vote, it's just too claustrophobic. Like, they're all privileged people sitting in their mansions. Whatever way the politics sways, they are not, that is not going to affect them.
Safe.
They're safe. They are living in their
they're
own.
They're safe.
Yeah.
Much like all, like a lot of us.
Right.
You know, we're safe. We're sound.
It is anecdotal, but I can say from my own experience that I have become more and more political after I was political to begin with, but
yes.
I was more like, okay, I'll just do my job, I'll study science, I'll do my science, I'll do research, that's what I think, that's what I love. But then when crisis started knocking at your own door, that is when the CA thing happened, and then I was like, okay, there's just, I can't just avoid being openly and loudly political.
I mean, that's what's happening with India also, right? That because of this crazy COVID situation, the Hindus also are now realizing that maybe Modi is not a good idea.
Right.
Because their cousins and their people are dying. So unless your house burns down, it's very easy to look away when a neighbor's house is burning.
Right.
But anyway, I mean, talking about our neighbors and all our organizations in Gadar, I wanted to move to our next section, which is joint effort. And Miraj, do you want to give us updates on what has happened in the last month in Gadar?
Yes, so we talked about the EU-India People's Summit in the last episode. And if you guys haven't listened it, go listen it. It is available on all podcast platforms. It was an 8-day long summit. The recordings are now available on YouTube. We will put the link for the video there. The London Story spearheaded that, but it was also joined by many organizations from all over the world in terms of support and amplification.
And then I want to say that the Gadar website has been launched. It is thegadar.org, thegadar. You can listen to our podcast there. You can see what's happening in the diasporic groups there.
We try to keep an update on all the current events so you can find if there is something happening in your locality. So we have started it. Over the coming weeks and months, we will have more and more content coming on it. If you are looking for what is happening around you, you can look at it. There are several features. You can browse through
right.
it. It's an amazing
yeah.
thing coming up.
Yeah, it's very intuitive, so you should have no problem. The Progressive Diaspora also signed a solidarity statement for the Palestinian struggle, which is going on right now. That should be on our website as well. It is very similar, in fact, I was thinking to like the Kashmir struggle of, you know, illegal occupation. I don't want to go into too much detail about it, but you can check out the statement that we made. There is also, we also wanted to highlight organizations that have collected money for COVID and how we should be cautious of the organizations on the right that are collecting money. As we said earlier, that it all gets, RSS funnels all the money, but we don't know where that goes. So we would definitely avoid those. Miraj, you want to give us, you can tell us the organizations briefly.
Recently, there was two articles in Al Jazeera that made some people very uncomfortable. And the story that was published was about RSS-linked organizations getting funding in millions of dollars. It's not the problem that organizations are getting funding for COVID relief. The problem is that these organizations which got funded are linked to RSS, and they fund RSS ideology, which is a fascist ideology in India. So that is the problem.
The last thing I want to say is on the Gadar website and Hindus for Human Rights websites, we have a list of vetted secular organizations that are working on the ground for COVID relief. A lot of them are known personally by us. And you can look them up and donate there. And speaking of COVID relief funding and vetted organizations, we have with us Sunita Vishwanath from Hindus for Human Rights. Miraj, do you want to introduce our lovely guest today?
Absolutely. Sunita has more than 25 years of experience in social activism. She has co-founded Women for Afghan Women, Sadhna, Hindus for Human Rights. And she has been involved with several other organizations, including the Sister Fund, Funders Concerned About AIDS, Population Media Center. And currently, she is serving as the Hindu Religious Life Advisor at the Columbia University, in addition to fighting back lawsuits that she has invited for her activism. So she is very outspoken, and that invited all the ire of the Hindutva Brigade. So you founded Women for Afghan Women in 2001, for which she was awarded Feminist Majority Foundation's Global Women's Rights Award in 2011 for her work with WAW, which is Women for Afghan Women, and the Champion of Change Award, which was given to her by the Obama administration in 2015 for her work with Sadhana. She co-founded HFHR, Hindus for Human Rights, in 2019, and she lives between Brooklyn, New York, and Taos, New Mexico. So that's a very brief introduction of Sunita. And Sunita, would you like to tell us why HFHR came into existence?
Yes, of course. So I'm born into an upper caste Hindu family in South India, and grew up in England, grew up in India, came to the States when I was a teenager, actually, and I've been here ever since, but been traveling between those homes of mine, and have grown up in a Hindu family and in a Hindu community, and have been noticing over the many years a shift in my own family and community, political, ideological shift. In 2001, when I was privileged, honored, you know, lucky enough to be in a space where I could bring a group of people together to address women's rights in Afghanistan. This was actually before 9/11 that this organization was happening. I actually, from my own, I may not have even said this publicly, but in my own heart, I felt I was doing my dharma as a good Hindu. Like, this is what I would do as a person who took the best of whatever my faith teaches me. I would work on the issues of marginalized, oppressed communities. And so Afghan women's rights was just such a natural issue. It moved me deeply. And I was able to be in a space where I could do that work. So in fact, it's funny, at that time when we were co-founding Women for Afghan Women, there was a person who said to me, why don't you focus on India? You know, just the kind of person that would say, you know, mind your own business. Go focus on your own, go back, go focus on your own people. And at that time, and we're talking about 2000, I was naive enough to think India's fine. India's fine. And I actually know it's absolute fact that India has very sophisticated, robust, evolved rights movements. I could go and, you know, be there. But in Afghanistan at that time, there wasn't a robust rights movement. So in my mind, I was like, I want to go where I'm most needed. So then over all these years, I'm 53 now, so many years to be thinking about, I was honestly so inspired by the people I was working with, the men and the women I was working with, and Women for Afghan Women, who are putting themselves in harm's way because they cared about women and girls. And if you think about the stereotype of Afghan men, about Islam, you wouldn't think so. You wouldn't think there would be these brave people who, because they care about little girls, that they would do this work day in, day out, where they don't know if they'll come home that day. So that working with Afghan men and women just kept bringing back the question to me, where are my people that are putting themselves in harm's way for what is right? And so, you know, you asked about Hindus for Human Rights, but I can't speak about Hindus for Human Rights without explaining the trajectory. So right. Sadhana came about because of my question. I am working shoulder to shoulder with Muslims, devout, faithful Muslims, whose expression of their faith is this incredible, inspiring human rights activism. And so sadhana was my first step, along with others. Everything is in a team. But to create a space for Hindus to come together and say, what does a practice of Hinduism look like if the people most marginalized are placed at the center? What does that look like? And so sadhana is 10 years old, and it's a space for that kind of existential question of what is an egalitarian Hinduism? What is an inclusive Hinduism? What do we do as progressive people who are Hindu about this atrocity of caste? So sadhana is a space where those questions are explored. Most of the people in sadhana are young and trying to figure those questions out. And so we can talk a bit more about sadhana if you like, but what was happening over all of those same years is that in India, which is where I'm from, this Hindutva, you know, I don't know, this Hindutva juggernaut, what I don't know what to call it, this, you know, massive force that has just grown slowly, you know, in recent years, it's been very rapid, the rise of power and, you know, the concentration of power. It became, even before, you know, sadhana was founded, even before 10 years ago, it was very palpable in the communities where I would show up, this rightward shift. But by the time Hindus for Human Rights was started, we founded ourselves after the second election of Modi. So
yes,
when Modi came into power for the second time, a bunch of us felt like things were extreme enough that there needed to be a separate platform for Hindus, progressive in Hindus, you know, progressive religious Hindus, secular Hindus, Hindus who weren't necessarily religious, but people who haven't sort of dropped the label Hindu, who want Hinduism to not represent Hindutva, to come together. And the platform of Hindus for Human Rights, and I want to emphasize this is because sadhana is a space where those other existential questions can be explored. But, but because that there's a space for those questions, Hindus for Human Rights can just get on full on with the work of advocacy.
So Sumita, when you talk about sadhana and how, you know, these marginalized groups, I just want to bring the focus back to them. How do you create allyship with, you know, Dalit organizations, like Muslim organizations? And I know you do with a lot with IAMC. How do you create, being the Savarna that, you know, background that both of us are from, and it's really, how do you create that allyship? Like, what do you raise awareness about caste? Like, how do you do that?
So one thing that I've been doing from the beginning of this journey as an out Hindu is just being very open about the issue of caste, placing caste as the first issue. If you're going to do work as a progressive Hindu, your first duty is to be open about the issue of caste and actually being an anti-caste or a caste abolitionist person. And there will be many who say that it is actually impossible to be Hindu and a caste abolitionist. You know, find me in 10 years and I hope I don't agree. I'm still here trying to say, no, we can do this. We at least are trying to do this. So in the beginning of sadhana, it was very hard because we were a new group on the horizon. And I completely understand why folks who are either from Dalit or OBC backgrounds or, you know, marginalized backgrounds, Muslim backgrounds, whatever all the various communities that are oppressed in a, either by Hinduism over, you know, all the
centuries
of years, you know, exactly, or marginalized communities that are oppressed under today's, you know, Hindutva India. I understand why there would be, you know, a feeling of, wait a minute, Hindu group, what is that? Let me check that out. I don't want to deal with that. I understand all of that. But on the issue of caste, it was hard. I can't tell a lie. The Dalit activists and organizations, we would show up, you know, bright eyed saying, we're in solidarity with you. And it would be met with, okay, we'd rather not. You do your work over there. And we have our work to do, which is, you know, about saving our people. So the question is, what do you do? I feel that whether it's a question of my own journey, right? As a person who wants to reform Hinduism, or if it's a question of pure, you know, take away my Hinduism or anybody's Hinduism, just a pure logic question. We want to do away with caste. How do we do that? One way is to make sure there are no Hindus left on the planet. Actually, that won't even get rid of it because caste is practiced in other communities too. So I would put to you that it's not possible to get a billion plus people to not be Hindu. I mean, I just don't think that's going to happen. So then what do you do? And I think that it's really critical that some of us who are Hindu work within the Hindu community to reform Hinduism.
You being somebody who has been really operating in this space, I wanted to put this question to you for all the listeners who are listening this podcast and who might have the same problem of finding it difficult to deal with that question when somebody puts it to them. Is that how do you deal with the contradiction of scriptural legitimacy of caste system in Hinduism and your mission of a casteless society?
So I think it's really important that anytime somebody, and I encounter this in my own community, that people say, well, caste is really bad, but it was outlawed in India. So it wasn't outlawed in India. Untouchability was technically, you know, outlawed in India, but I know it still happens. I mean, the fact that they're saying, oh, caste is bad, it's been outlawed, they're coming from a place of saying it's you know, they're coming from a good place of saying, you know, that caste is a bad thing, it shouldn't exist. And so I think putting forward facts that they can't really, you know, deny because they are facts about how caste has not been, you know, eradicated from the world is very important to engage in those conversations. And then, you know, one thing that I always say is if caste discrimination doesn't exist anymore, then how do you explain that, I don't know, something like 99.9% of manual scavengers in India are Dalit? So if that's not proof that there's, you know, a caste system in India, then, and then, you know, and people will say, well, that's, you know, we must be that because of the caste system, the people who occupy the poorest, you know, strata in society are Dalit and they must be going. Like, no, think about it. This is the job, the dirtiest job that nobody wants to do. And the only people that are going into that particular job are Dalits. You have to have more self-awareness than that. The only reason why India allows that to happen is because those people who do it are expendable. They're not considered human. About the scripture, in Hinduism, we have, and you know, what I find completely liberating and empowering about, you know, the tensions I encounter when I deal with our Hindu texts is the fact that Hindu texts are divided into two sort of broad categories, Smriti texts and Shruti texts. Now, the Shruti texts, our Shruti is translated as what is heard. Those are the most authoritative texts. They are considered, you know, divinely revealed to our ancient sages, revealed by God. They certainly didn't write them. They or themselves, they're authorless and they're timeless. And so those Shruti texts, include the Vedas, the Upanishads, and some people think that the Gita also is in that most authoritative text category. And then we have most of the, all of the other texts, like the epics and the Puranas and, you know, most of what we would read as kids growing up come from this other category of texts, which is Smriti texts, which means that which is remembered. And these texts, traditionally, they have an author, a human author, and they can be dated to some time. And so what it means is that, you know, we have this philosophy that was, articulated in these very ancient texts, which are the highest authority. And then based on that philosophy, and that philosophy is quite diverse also, there's many schools of thought, but based on those Shruti texts, people, living people, have created texts, scripture, which we all embrace as, you know, our religious scripture. And what that means is that we too, I mean, the religion, any religion is a living thing. And it, and every day it changes. Change is inevitable. Change is a part of, you know, existence. And so Smriti texts are something that we can be empowered to even create. So this tells me that it is completely within the scope of a lived Hinduism that some people who have completely egalitarian and inclusive views and are Hindu can create a theology for our times. And most of the people who come to us, you know, desiring such a new modern way of being a Hindu, they are suffocating in the mainstream Hindu space. And they would just leave the space. They would just leave that fold and either just leave religion or find places like Unitarian Universalist spaces. You know, they wouldn't stay in those mainstream Hindu spaces, which are, you know, just either like in the best case scenario, just choosing to ignore the bigotry, in the worst case scenario, are perpetuating the bigotry. So now, if we want to organize in the Hindu space, if we want to work on human rights in India, I put to you, I argue, you cannot sidestep religion. And that's what we are doing, but there's much more pushback on us for doing this work as Hindus. And I want to challenge the people pushing back to say, why wasn't there pushback on an organization like Women for Afghan Women, completely, you know, delving into Islam as a resource to help women, and it works. Why can we not in this work delve into the resources of Hinduism to change the hearts and minds of Hindus so that they no longer see Hindutva as the force that's going to liberate them? It's a challenge. It's a question.
Yeah, speaking of this exponential rise of Hindutva, just coming back to that a little bit, how important do you think that Hindus denounce it? Like, what are the pitfalls? Obviously, we are seeing it in the current administration, but
I think the only way to defeat Hindutva is if Hindus denounce it. I also don't think that just Hindus can do it.
That's true.
I think it needs that broad coalition, which the left, Muslim, Christian, Dalit, the coalitions that maybe were a little bit, you know, not willing to have Hindus among them for, again, as I say, understandable reasons. I'm really heartened that just by us, Hindus for Human Rights and Sadhana, being in some of those coalitions, that the space has been opened up and some trust has been extended so that we can be there. And we have to then not in any way misuse that trust and be very conscientious about internal, you know, like just whatever privileges and biases that might be inside us, be prepared to be pushed back on, to be prepared to step back and listen. Right now you're asking me these questions, so I'm taking up all this space and talking to you, but I shouldn't be doing this. There's some times that I should be doing this. And now with this COVID nightmare, people who have never breathed a word against this administration are angry, are hurting, are confused and completely disillusioned. The fact that some Hindus who were supportive of this government are at this moment thinking, what is going on? That's a moment when somebody like Hindus for Human Rights can speak up and listen rather than shut it out, actually listen and think again for a moment. So this is a moment where I think, even if it makes, you know, some non-Hindus a little uncomfortable, Hindus for Human Rights is speaking up because there'll be 2 seconds where that will be the situation where Hindus might pay attention. Then after that, it'll go away. And, you know, we see petitions circulating about calling for the resignation of Modi. So I think that's fine. I mean, of course, we want the resignation. That sounds fine. But actually, I would say that we need to be arguing, we need to be using this moment to reveal that it's not just one politician or one party, it's the ideology. So Hindus are being killed right now by Hindutva ideology. Yeah.
So recently, HAF filed a lawsuit against you, and you alluded to that, including IAMC and other organizations. So can you talk a bit about that?
Whatever the lawyers have told you, you can tell us.
Yes. Well, whatever you can talk about,
So I've written a little bit about it, and you can see that. I don't want to talk about the details of the lawsuit. Our lawyers have said that's not a great idea. But what I will say is that it hasn't stopped us. It makes us, because it's an act of aggression, it makes us feel even more determined to do this work. We are in a country which has very strong First Amendment rights. We can express our opinion. In a case of a human rights advocacy organization, it's our mission to express our opinion. The lawsuit has the number 75 million. So we don't have money. So we're lucky that we have pro bono legal representation, because we couldn't afford to do this any other way. We're a small organization without funding. And the only other thing I want to say about it is that the lawsuit is against two Hindus, a Muslim, a Christian, and a scholar.
Yes.
And our work is to preserve and protect and defend and lift up a secular idea of India that includes Hindus, Muslims, Christians. And we can add, they didn't sue Dalits.
If you get sued. If you get sued, you're doing something right, Sunita. So there you go.
And of course, scholars who are the people who are in charge of our thinking minds, the group that has been sued together is the very thing that we're fighting for. And we have pro bono legal representation, but I don't know for a fact, actually, but I suspect that they've paid for their legal representation. And if that is the case, then I'm deeply, deeply chagrined that the amount of money that it would cost to retain a law firm like Harder, which is the Trumps and Harvey Weinstein's law firm, that money, I just question how many oxygen cylinders could have been bought with that money. I think, and so I just, on so many levels, I'm saddened by this, but it hasn't slowed us down.
I want to tell our listeners that Hindus for Human Rights, there's a statement on their website that they can see. And there's about 300 academics, including Noam Chomsky, P. Sainanth, filmmakers like Anand Pathwardhan, obviously Cornel West, Romila Thapar, everyone in the academic space has signed in support for Sunita, her organization, and the others that we talked about, the five people, the Fab Five. Well, I'm glad you're getting publicity through this.
We will use our human rights mission is that's our mandate.
Yeah.
So we will use whatever is thrown at us to make a platform to speak about Hindutva, caste, and human rights.
Yeah. I also wanted to ask you about COVID crisis, and I know that you're collaborating with grassroots organizations in India. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, we have our own list of grassroots nonprofit organizations. It's on our website. Each one of the groups on our website are groups that we know personally. On trips to India, we have met them, seen their work with our own eyes. We know that they're inclusive. That's really important for us. And we vouch for these organizations. They're grassroots organizations. They were doing work, during the first wave of COVID. They were doing work before COVID even came. And they're certainly on the ground doing work in this just horrific second wave. And the sad thing is, this administration has made it hard for these groups to raise money. So everybody is trying to figure out a way that's legal to support the groups on the ground that are serving the most marginalized communities.
it's so much easier now to get money funneled from Hindutva groups than it is to, I mean, it's a fact and you can look it up, but it is very easy for groups which are connected to RSS to funnel money rather than nonprofit groups.
And then I just hope that those groups are reaching the most marginalized community, because getting the money, if anybody's listening and you're from a group that's getting money from India, please make sure that the Dalit community, the Muslim community in the place that you're serving, you know, is reached with your services.
Definitely. That is amazing. That is so good to hear. And, you know, like I see all of you doing such amazing work. It gives us hope that all is not lost. I wanted to ask you one last question. We talked about your activism. It's been a lot of years that you've been in this space. What keeps you going?
I think honestly, what keeps me going is my kids. Mm-hmm. My kids are, and my kids aren't just my biological kids. My kids are all the kids that Women for Afghan Women serves. And some 30 of them that are under our roof have nowhere to go. Mm-hmm. And the situation in Afghanistan right now is the worst that it has been since 2001 when we started. Mm-hmm. It's about to descend into civil war, and Taliban might even be part of Afghanistan's future. And I mean, it will be actually. I mean, it's as dire as it can be. And these kids that we have many, many, many kids and women who are with us, but there's a certain group of kids that have nowhere to go. We are their family. We are their home. And those kids, my own three boys that came from me, and then I have two goddaughters, two wonderful goddaughters. One is Afghan, one is Indian, she lives in Canada. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, when you ask the question, what comes in my mind just as an image is these young people whom I love with all my heart, and I want a world where they can thrive. And then you have, who builds that world? Who gives them a world that they can thrive in? It's us, it's on us.
Yeah.
That's it.
I think on that wonderful note, we hope this lawsuit actually makes you more famous. And then you have many more chapters and many more kids. Because we want that to happen. We want more organizations to take up what you're taking up, working within the system, working, which is Hinduism. I'm just going to call it a system right now, but working within the system to actually eradicate the evils that come with it. Good luck to you and Hindus for Human Rights, Women for Afghan Women, and Sadhana, and all the innumerable organizations that you're a part of, which we haven't mentioned. from our team, Hindu Muslim Hi Hi, Miraj and I, thank you so much for coming on to our little show. And
it was so much fun. And I love Hindu Muslim Hi Hi, name and the spirit.
Do you,
and it's exactly what we need.
Do you always say go Corona go? That's how you have been saying
Hindu Muslim Bye. Hi Hi. And for now, because we're saying goodbye, bye.
I think our listeners should watch the clip where we have people just chanting Go Corona Go, and they think that's going to cure Corona. This was early pandemic, guys, in India.
Anyway, please subscribe to our podcast. Share it with your friends. We are on all major platforms, Amazon Music, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and do follow us on our social media handles, which is the_Ghadar, THE_GHADAR. And I think we should end with Go Corona Go. So at the countdown, let's start. 1, 2, 3, Go Corona Go.
Go Corona Go.
Go Corona.
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 Go Corona.